You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
Look at popular attitudes. Pew does regular polling. They recently ran a poll in which they asked people to rank in priority urgent issues, gave them a couple dozen choices. One choice was not even listed: nuclear war, which is as great a threat as climate change. That's considered so marginal they didn't even list it as an option. Well, climate change was there. It was way down near the bottom.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. Welcome to this special program celebrating Noam Chomsky's 95th birthday. Where does one start to describe Chomsky, his vast body of scholarship and wide influence? He was born in Philadelphia on December 7, 1928. By any measure, he has led a most extraordinary life. In one index, he is ranked as the eighth most cited person in history, right up there with Aristotle, Shakespeare, Marx, Plato, and Freud. His contributions to modern linguistics are seminal. In addition to his pioneering work in that field, he's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Chris Hedges says, he's America's greatest intellectual who makes the powerful as well as their liberal apologists deeply uncomfortable. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. On a personal note, I'm often asked, how did I connect with Chomsky? Quite simply, I wrote him a letter and he responded. He encouraged me to begin Alternative Radio. We did our first interview in 1984. Since then, we've done scores of programs and books. At 95, he continues to inform and inspire people all over the world. This program, When Lunatics Run the Asylum, was recorded earlier this year. He was at his home in Arizona. It's good to see you again.
Always good to see you.
The UN's IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued its latest report. The new IPCC assessment from senior scientists warned there's little time to lose in tackling climate change. UN Secretary General Guterres said, "The rate of temperature rise in the last half century is the highest in 2,000 years. Concentrations of carbon dioxide are at their highest in at least 2 million years. The climate time bomb is ticking." Then he added, "We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator. It is the defining issue of our age. It is the central challenge of our century." So my question to you, Noam, is you would think survival would be a galvanizing issue, but there doesn't seem to be much sense of urgency to address it in a substantial way.
It was a very strong statement. Good chairs, I think it should be stronger. It's not just the defining issue of this century. It's the defining issue of human history. The report was very stark and clear. We're reaching a point where there will be irreversible processes set into motion. Doesn't mean that everybody's going to die tomorrow, but it'll mean we'll pass tipping points where nothing more can be done, where it's just decline to disaster, and the disaster will be very serious. So yes, it is a question of survival, of any form of organized human society. Already many signs of extreme danger and threat, almost entirely so far among the countries that have had the least, smallest role in producing the disaster. It's often said, it's correctly, that the rich countries have created the disaster, the poor countries are the victims. It's actually a little more nuanced. It's the rich in the rich countries who have created the disaster, and everyone else, including the poor in the rich countries, are facing the problems. So what's happening? Well, take the United States. It's two political parties. One political party is 100% denialist. It's not happening. Or if it's happening, it's none of our business. The Inflation Reduction Act, basically a climate act that Biden managed to get through Congress, sharply whittled down from the original. Not a single Republican voted for it. No Republican will vote for anything that harms the profits of the rich and the corporate sector, which they abjectly serve. We should remember that this is not built in. You go back to 2008, McCain was running. He had a small climate program, not much, but something. Congress, including the Republicans, were considering doing something about what everyone knew was an impending crisis. The Koch brothers, huge energy conglomerate, got wind of it. They had been working for years to ensure that the Republicans would be loyally supporting their campaign to destroy human civilization. Here there was deviation. They launched an enormous juggernaut, bribing, intimidating, astroturfs, lobbying, a major campaign to return the Republicans to total denialism, and they succeeded. Since then, denialist party. The last Republican primary, 2016, before Trump took over the party, all the top Republican figures were vying for the nomination. Every single one of them, without exception, said either there's no global warming, or maybe there is, but it's none of our business. Not a sign of deviation from let's race to destruction in order to ensure that our prime constituency is as rich and powerful as possible. Now, what about the other party? There was, I think, mainly Sanders' initiative and the Sunrise Movement activism and others. Biden at first had a moderately decent climate program, not enough, but a big step forward beyond anything in the past. It was cut down step by step by 100% Republican opposition, a couple of right-wing Democrats, Manchin, Sinema, a couple others. What finally came out is the Inflation Reduction Act. It's something, but if you take a look at it, the only way it could get through is by providing gifts to the energy corporations, to provide them with support for their favorite projects of expansion, provide them with subsidies, make sure that they get something. It brings to the fore the ultimate insanity of our institutional structure. You want to stop destroying the planet and destroying human life on Earth? What you have to do is bribe the rich and the powerful, so maybe they'll come along. It's kind of as if Mexico decided that the way to deal to prevent the cartels from killing tens of thousands of Mexicans is say, let's bribe them. Maybe if we offer them enough candy, they'll stop killing people. That's built into our institutional structure. That's savage capitalism. You want to get anything done? You have to bribe those who own the place. Maybe they'll be nice. Well, aside from the lunacy, look what's happening. oil prices are going way out of sight. So the energy corporations have explained, sorry, boys, no more sustainable energy. We make more money by destroying you. Even BP, the one company that was beginning to do something, said, no, we make more profit from destroying everything, so we're going to do that. It became very clear at the Glasgow conference that John Kerry, the U.S. representative, was euphoric. He said, we've won. We now have the market on our side. We have the corporations on our side. How can we lose? BlackRock, Larry Fink just said, look, we're going to support you. We control, I forget what it is, $130 trillion or some astronomical sum, and we're going to use it for sustainable energy. We've won. Well, it was a small footnote pointed out by political economist Adam Tooze. He said, yes, they said that, but with a condition, two conditions. One, we'll join you as long as it's profitable. Two, there has to be an international guarantee that if we suffer any loss, we're paid. The taxpayer pays. That's what's called free enterprise. It means we take risks. We make a ton of money. When there's a collapse, as there will be, you, the friendly taxpayer, come in and bail us out. We're just seeing it happen again with the banking crisis. That's free enterprise, what the libertarians tell us we should love. With this institutional structure, it's going to be very hard to get out of this. So what's the Biden administration doing? Well, let's take the Willow Project. Right now, it's opening up a major project in Alaska, which will bring online more and more fossil fuels for decades. There is what's called a positive side. This is a ConocoPhillips project, and they're using methods, known methods, to harden the permafrost. One of the great dangers is that the permafrost is melting, which covers an enormous amount of hidden fossil fuels, which will come into the atmosphere and be monstrous. So they're hardening the permafrost. Big step forward. Why are they doing it? So they can use it to exploit oil more effectively. That's savage capitalism right in front of our eyes, wrought with stark clarity. Takes genius to suppress it and not to see it. But it's being done. Look at popular attitudes. Pew does regular polling. They recently ran a poll in which they asked people to rank in priority urgent issues, gave them a couple dozen choices. One choice was not even listed, nuclear war, which is as great a threat as climate change. That's considered so marginal, they didn't even list it as an option. Well, climate change was there. It was way down near the bottom. Much more important was the budget deficit, which is not a problem at all. But climate change was mentioned by Republicans, barely mentioned. 13% of Republicans, that's almost statistical error, thought it was an urgent problem. More Democrats, but not enough. This is a deeply propagandized society, not only on this issue. Take another issue, which is right on the front pages. Iran, nuclear programs. 60% of Americans think that Iran has nuclear weapons. U.S. intelligence says, no, of course they don't. They don't have programs for them. 60% of Americans think that Iran has nuclear weapons. That's more Americans than think that Israel has nuclear weapons, which obviously it does. That's effective propaganda. It's astonishing. And it's not only here. You get the same things in Britain, other places. That's the world we live in. Meanwhile, to get back to the climate, yes, remember that Guterres also said that we have time. We know answers. We have a short time in which we can do something. That's the crucial issue. Can people who care about minimal human values, like, say, survival, can they organize and act effectively enough to overcome not only governments, but the capitalist institutions which are designed for suicide?
The Biden-approved Willow Project, this massive new oil drilling in Alaska, is not a definition of lunacy. I don't know what is. But let me ask you also, you know, a question always comes up, and you've heard it a million times. These guys, these owners of the economy, the captains of industry, the CEOs, they have children, they have grandchildren. How can they not think of their future and protecting them rather than putting them at risk?
Put yourself in their chair. Let's say you're the CEO of J.P. Morgan. You replace Jamie Dimon. You know perfectly well that when you fund fossil fuels, as he's doing, you're destroying the lives of your grandchildren. I can't read his mind, but I can imagine. I suspect what's going through his mind is this. Look, if I don't do this, I'll be kicked out, and somebody else will be put in who will do it, because that's the nature of the institutions. The nature of the institutions is you aim for profit and market share, and if you don't do it, you're kicked out. Somebody else will come in and do it. Now, that other person who'll come in is not as nice a guy as I am. I mean, I at least know that we're destroying everything, and I try to mitigate it slightly. That next guy who comes in won't give a damn. He'll just race towards destruction. So as a benefactor of the human race, I will continue to fund fossil fuel development. That's a convincing position. And I suspect it's the position of just about all the people who are doing this. For 40 years, you know the ExxonMobil story. I don't have to review it for you. The ExxonMobil scientists were way in the lead in discovering the threats and extreme dangers of global warming. They were informing management for years that we're destroying the world. It was tucked away in some drawer somewhere. 1988, James Hansen, famous geophysicist, gave public Senate testimony, said, look, we're racing to disaster. The management of ExxonMobil and the other companies had to consider this. We can't just put it in the drawer anymore. They called in their PR experts and said, how should we handle this? And they gave good advice. They said, don't deny it. If you deny it, you'll be exposed right away. So don't deny it. Just cast doubt. Say, maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. We haven't really looked into all the possibilities. We haven't understood sunspots. Some questions about cloud cover. So let's go on and just become a richer, more developed society. Small footnote, we'll make a lot more profit. We'll become a richer, more developed society. And later on, if there's any reality to this, we'll be in a better position to challenge it, to deal with it. It worked very well. That was the propaganda line. Very successful. That's effective PR. And then you get things like the Koch brothers juggernaut buying the Republican Party, or what used to be a political party, and turning them into total denialists. And then you have the propaganda that suppresses it all, saying maybe it's not real, maybe it's a liberal hoax, and so on. Now, the Democrats contributed to this in other ways. One of the interesting things about the recent elections is the areas in along the border in Texas, Mexican-American areas, which were always voted Democrat. Last election, they voted for Trump. Why? What's in their minds? You can easily see. I got a job. I've got a job in the oil industry. The Democrats are saying they want to take away my job. They want to destroy my family. All because of these liberal elitists claim there's some global warming going on. Why should I believe them? Okay, can understand that. Let's vote for Trump, who wants to get rid of it all the most fast as possible. At least I'll have a job and I'll be able to feed my family. What the Democrats didn't do was go down there, organize, educate, and say, look, folks, the environmental crisis is real. It's going to destroy you and your families. You can get better jobs in sustainable energy. Your families will be better off. Your children will be better off. You'll be better off. It's all true. They didn't do it. Actually, in places where they did do it, they won. One of the most striking cases is West Virginia, coal state. Joe Manchin, senator from the coal industry, is blocking everything. My friend and colleague, Bob Pollan, and his group at the University of Massachusetts, Perry Group, have been working on the ground there. And they have succeeded in getting to the point where the mine workers themselves are calling for a transition to sustainable energy. The United Mine Workers passed resolutions calling for it. Let's put the miners to work, capping the mines, moving towards sustainable energy projects, government subsidy for it, which there should be, have a much better world. Same was done with unions in Ohio, in California. It should not come as a great surprise. Look back at the history. The earliest active environmentalists were actually the unions, the Oil, Atomic, Chemical Energies Union, and Tony Mazzocchi was the leading figure. He was critical, anti-capitalist, pro-union, pro-worker organizer. He led the mine workers back in the early 70s to initiate some of the major early environmental positions. Later, he tried to organize a labor party, which would carry this forward. Is that inconceivable? Maybe not. Well, a lot of power sectors are opposed to it. The owners of the economy, the media, and Congress, they're not going to like it, but popular activism could work.
Talk more about what's going on in the banking sector in view of the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank, which was followed by Signature Bank and their problems at First Republic Bank. You know, what is the role of the Fed in regulating the banking sector?
Well, first of all, I don't claim any special expertise in this, but the people who do, serious economists who are also honest about it, like Paul Krugman, says very simply, we don't know. The system is designed, deeply structured, so that this goes back to almost 45 years to the deregulation mania. Deregulate finance. What's going to happen is you shift to a financial-based economy, deindustrialize the country. You make your money out of finance, not out of building things, risky endeavors, which are very profitable, but they're going to lead to a crash. When they lead to a crash, you call on the government, meaning the taxpayer, to bail you out. There weren't any major banking crises in the 50s and the 60s, the big growth period. Of course, the Treasury Department was keeping control of the banking industry. A bank those days was a bank. You had some extra money, you put it into the bank. Somebody came and borrowed money to buy a car or send his kid to college or something. That was the banking industry. It started a little bit with Carter, but an avalanche with Reagan. And then you get people like Larry Summer saying, let's deregulate derivatives, let's throw the whole thing open. Okay, one crisis after another. The first one was early in the Reagan years, the Continental Illinois crash, which the friendly taxpayer paid for. Reagan administration ended with a huge savings and loan crisis. Again, call in the friendly taxpayer. The rich make plenty of money, they're fine, but the rest pay the costs. It's what Bob Pollan and Jerry Epstein called the bailout economy. That's our economy. A free enterprise, make money as long as you can. Obvious crises came along. Public bails you out. The biggest one was 2008. Go back to 2008. What happened? Thanks to the deregulation of complicated financial products like derivatives and others, initiative of Larry Summers, the banking industry and so on, under Clinton, you got a crash in the housing industry. It all collapsed. Plenty of money made, but a crash. Then it led to a crash in the financial industries. The Congress did pass legislation, TARP legislation, had two components. One component was to bail out the gangsters who had caused the crisis by subprime mortgages, loans they know would never be paid, and distribute them through derivatives, so nobody who owns what, and so on. So bail those guys out. There was a second part of the legislation. Do something for the victims, the people who had lost their homes, who'd been kicked out on the street with foreclosures. Do something for them. Well, guess which half of the legislation Obama implemented? Okay. It was such a scandal that the Inspector General of the Treasury Department, Neil Barofsky, wrote a op-eds and even a book about it, denouncing what had happened. No effect. That's the way the institutions work. It did have an effect in the working class. Lots of workers who voted for Obama, believing this hope and change, shifted. They're Trump voters. And they have reasons. We were betrayed by the party that claimed to be for us.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky, When Lunatics Run the Asylum. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, alternativeradio.org. The Ukraine war is now in its second year with no end in sight. China has proposed a peace plan to end the war. What are the chances of realistic chances of that happening anytime soon?
Depends on the participants in the war. Almost the entire world, global south, it's most of the world, is calling for some kind of negotiated settlement to put an end to the horrors before they get worse. Of course, the invasion is a criminal act of aggression. No question about that. Ukrainians have a right to defend themselves. I don't think there should be any question about that. The question is, will the United States agree to allow negotiations to take place? The official U.S. position is the war must continue in order to severely weaken Russia. In fact, the United States is actually getting a bargain out of this, so much so that it's being openly discussed in the United States and Britain with a small fraction of the colossal U.S. military budget. The U.S. is severely degrading its major military opponent, Russia. Doesn't have much of an economy, but has a huge military. That's a bargain. You can ask whether that's why they're doing it, but it's a fact. There's a pretext. The pretext is if we continue to support the war will put Ukraine in a better negotiating position.